Mr. Trofimov, reel two.
Another factor that probably came into wanting to get together is that he didn't speak any English, or very little, and clearly he needed someone that spoke French fluently so that we could work together. Otherwise, it would have been extremely difficult in his case. And with regard to the radio operator, he was more or less allocated to us, but he fitted in very well. He was a young French French lieutenant.
Do you remember his name?
Deschamps, yes. And I can give you the some of the names. I've got them in notes and things. Again, I have to remind you that at that time, they were all under nom de guerre. For instance, the French officer I was with was known as Dumas. That was his nom de guerre. I never knew his name till well after the war, his real name. Deschamps, I think, was the operator's real name. I'd have to look it up. Sorry about that.
And the name of your team?
Guy. G-U-Y.
How did that come about?
I don't know. The people that dropped into France were, in the main, in the north of France, had Christian names allocated to them. Curiously enough, those that went into the south of France from North Africa had chemical names and various peculiar names like that. But if you look at the map, which I can show you, you'll find they're all
we'll look at it afterwards.
Yes, you'll find them all a series of Christian names, and ours, we were allocated the name Guy.
How did you set about coordinating with each other? And
from the time that the marriage took place, it was referred to as a marriage at the time, you spent more time together and you did things together. And there was certain exercises where you went out as a team and you operated together so that you had a chance to get to observe each other's mannerisms, reactions, and also whether really you were whether it was a suitable marriage.
Did everything go smoothly, or were there hitches from that point of view?
Not really, no. I think the only hitch that possibly occurred, not just with my own team, but I believe several others, is that we were the ones, the British side, were essentially loners and individuals. The French came from regiments, and though they were volunteers like ourselves, I think they had a more regimental background. And idea of guerrilla warfare was, in certain instances, a little alien to their natural instincts or their background training. And I think that there was a slight, I wouldn't say rift, but désaccord. There was a slight difference of opinions, difference of approach, call it what you may, that one felt it was there.
During this period, did any doubt cross your mind about what you might call morality of guerrilla warfare? Because you brought up this question of regimental attitudes, and there is a strong attitude amongst regimental soldiers that guerrilla warfare is illegitimate. Did that crop up at all, either personally or amongst the people you were with?
No, I don't think I ever came across it with any of the fellow Jeds. I certainly never entertained the thought whatsoever. I thought it was a wonderful concept that here were a team of international team, allied officers, going in to help coordinate the resistance. Now, if you think of it, the resistance in France was in many instances working blind. They weren't working with instructions. They were attacking the Germans to the best of their abilities or making life uncomfortable for the Germans. But in many instances, this didn't necessarily fall in with what was required by the Allied advancing forces or landing forces. So what our role was to be is that we were to go in and organize and equip the resistance, where necessary, provide leadership, but not push that point for obvious reasons, locate areas where there would be suitable dropping zones to bring in equipment, arms, clothing, medical, etc., and pass on the requirements of the Allied forces to each of these areas, so that if bridges had to be blown up, well, they were blown up, or if you could. But in certain instances, they didn't want that to happen. Or they wanted certain areas to be mined, railway communications, or they wanted attacks on certain garrisons and such like, harassing the enemy as much as possible. And I thought it was a brilliant concept to have a paramilitary setup. We were not, in any sense, spies. That never came into our brief. We were paramilitary, so it was a coordinating role. It was making sure that that vast potential on the ground was being put to really useful purpose. Otherwise, we could have got into a situation where they were doing things which might have been harmful or slowed down the progress of our troops.
Can we go on now to the actual preparation you had for going into France, as opposed to the training, the briefing which you had about what to expect there and wartime conditions in France? Did you feel, how was that done, and did you feel it was adequate?
No, I think that our briefing was ill thought out. First of all, the first thing that I felt very surprised about and later on angry about was that they wanted us to go into Ille-et-Vilaine but dropped us into Mayenne. Now, don't forget, we were being dropped in uniform. They had lost all touch with resistance groups in Ille-et-Vilaine since, I think it was March 44, looking up my old notes. And at the briefing, it was a French colonel who carried it out. He gave us our tasks, which were to locate suitable dropping zones, to bring in material and personnel, try and locate any groups of existing groups of resistance in the area, I'm talking about Ille-et-Vilaine, and then await further orders. As it happens, when we parachuted in, we were a tremendous embarrassment to the committee that received us, because we were in uniform. We were also dropped some 75 miles from our destination. Well, because of the uniform factor, we could only travel at night, very heavily laden, and really between about, you know, from about midnight till 3 or 4 in the morning. And so the progress was obviously going to be very slow. We later found out that there had been several drops into Ilivilen round about the time that we were dropped in. So they could have, a little by a little bit more background research, they could have established that this group, that there were groups that we could have dropped into, reception committees, which would have altered the whole picture for us. There were also one or two rather fanciful suggestions put to us. One was that we were to try and attack when we'd got our resistance groups together, of course. We were to try and attack a certain small airport near Rennes, hold it, and the colonel who was briefing us was going to fly in and take over command. Well, of course, all this didn't happen.
And can you say which part of France Ille-et-Vilaine is, please?
Yes, it's in Brittany. Yes. Yeah. We were dropped at a place called Courtisay, which is southwest of Alençon. Alençon is a big market town. And I actually landed on a road, and it nearly knocked me out because I had my carbine just underneath my chin with a pack here and all our emergency equipment. And the butt of this carbine came up and hit me on the chin. And I was quite, I was a bit dazed for a few seconds.
But going back to the briefing, before we actually take up the operations, what did you think to the advice they gave you about behaving in occupied France from the security point of view?
Behaving? I'm not terribly sure what you're getting at. We would warned that the area was we were warned that there were very few resistance groups operating because the Gestapo had been extremely successful in clearing out active groups of resistance. By that I mean a maquis, the people who lived together in rough. We were informed that the main source of help would be through sedentary resistance people. These are sort of people that were carrying out ordinary jobs in the daytime, but were prepared to do fight the Germans in whatever capacity they were able to at night and then return to their jobs. Certainly throughout this was a great problem for us because when we did land in though we were received by a committee at night, that committee disappeared the next day back to their jobs, etc. And so in the daytime, we had to hide up and could only move at night initially. I think they, in the briefing, they could have perhaps gone into this a little bit more because clearly, to drop people in uniform 75 miles away from their ultimate destination was going to give rise to a whole series of almost unsurmountable problems. And I don't think that the briefing took that into account as much as they might have done.
Now, can you take me through, step by step, the process of actually getting into France as you remember it?
Well, obviously we dropped, we parachuted into France. And I've already told you, we had a committee to meet us. I was dropped some distance from the dropping zone and landed on a road. But eventually, I gathered my parachute. And I think I've already told you, I was dazed a little bit because the butt of the carbine hit my chin. And whether it was for that reason or not, I forgot the password. And suddenly I saw a shadow the other side of a hedge. And I didn't know whether it was a Frenchman or a German. I know I got my 4-5 Colt out and ready. And the man the other side said, "Mud bass." And I couldn't remember it. Couldn't have just gone completely out of my mind. So, you know, it's an amusing sort of side thing. But eventually, I said, "Look, you can check with so-and-so. If you are a bona fide resistance man, there should be two other people, you know." So, and in my group, we also dropped with another group who were due to go to north of Ille-et-Vilaine. Our destination was south of Ille-et-Vilaine. We assembled on the dropping zone, and my throat was absolutely parched at the time, possibly the excitement mixed with fear, etc. And I said to one of these Frenchmen who was in the reception committee, I said, "I'd give anything for a drink." And he brought out a flask and offered it me. And I took a swig. He said it was coffee. What it was about 50% coffee and 50% Calvados. And it... I thought he was trying to kill me. It just scorched its way down. And I have never forgotten that. And what I nearly called him. After that, we were taken to a farm some distance away. And we were put in the barn that night. And we spent our first night up on a ledge in this barn, some distance from the main house. You want me to go on?
Please.
Yes. There are, fortunately, in all these things, amusing little situations, and one occurred the very first morning, our very first morning in France. There was a bucket, put for obvious reasons, down on the ground, and it was near the door. And when I woke up, I decided I wanted to spend a penny, so I went down and was getting on with doing so, when through a crack in the door, I saw a vehicle outside with Antonine, all sorts of things sticking on it. And I thought, my God, this is the German reconnaissance, the radio detector vans. So I signaled to the other chaps, be quiet. And we pulled up the ladder and all lay there with us, expecting that's it, you know, we'd have to fight our way out of it. What had actually happened was that the Germans had realized or had found out that there'd been a drop the night before, and they were going around trying to locate any radio operations and so on. And they'd switched off their equipment when they got to the farm and went in to get some coffee or a drink. And, of course, came out again, switched on and carried on. But it was a very quick lesson in how careful one had to be, and how chance could have, you know, played it, you know, it could have been the end of us. That was the very first incident. Now, from then onwards, life became very, very difficult indeed. First of all, as I've mentioned, we were in uniform, which was a tremendous embarrassment to the such resistance contacts as we had, who were mainly, as I said, sedentary, ordinary people working, you know, operating at night. It also meant that we could only move from safe house to safe house. And they're not easy to come by because the Gestapo, the Germans, if they found anybody had had a parachutist or a member from F section or anybody, or resistance, any kind of resistance operation under their roof, sheltered under their roof, their farms were burnt down and they were taken away to camps and tortured and so on. So clearly there weren't all that many safe houses available. And we set about marching at night, carrying all this equipment. The radio equipment itself is, you know, it's the B2 set, the JED set, and generator. Weighs quite a bit. And we all had to lend a hand. So we were walking, so we didn't achieve many miles. And we got to one stage. We were being put up in a barn right out in the country, and we had nowhere to go from there. No contacts. And I said to the others, look, I've heard through talking to one of the guides that came with us at night that there is an agent operating somewhere in this area. And I said, I can't go in uniform, so I'm going to get myself some civilian clothes. And I got our contact in that area to dress me up in borrowed clothes. And I set off. He lent me a bicycle, and I set off. And I was taken to, and his war code name was Michel. Later on, we all knew that it was Claude de Bessac, a very famous operator. He wasn't a JED. This would be under F section. And he came back with us, and I'll never forget, he was the most extraordinary fellow. He was singing in English on the bicycle, at the top of his voice. And we went through one village where there were some Germans sitting having a drink, a glass of beer, and he never stopped singing, just carried on. I don't know whether it was to, it was a bit of bravado, or whether it was to, you know, ease my tension, obviously, and being in civilian clothes is quite a change and has very different implications if you're caught. Anyhow, he came and we sorted out with him a program for to enable us to get on with our journey. What he did, in fact, was put us in contact with a member of the FDP whose code name was Lulu. His real name is Commandant Petri. He organized a doctor to transport all our heavy gear in a car marked with a red cross on the top of it, which meant that we could move much more quickly. And in fact, we borrowed bicycles at certain stages of our trip. We eventually got to a place called Goron in Mayenne, G-O-R-R-O-N, And we were staying at a farm, and we were still making very slow progress. We needed to speed things up. And we decided that the best thing to do is to try and buy an old car. So we put feelers out, and eventually we located somebody who was prepared to sell us an old car, it's a really old thing, for the price of 10,000 francs. You know, we're talking about old francs now. And we duly got ready, and we got all assembled. We got into this car, and I think we'd only been going about half an hour when we ran into a German patrol. Well, we split from the car on both sides, and we had a point de repère, a place to go to. But the way it worked out, the Germans apparently came down one side and weren't quite sure what had happened, and one of our blokes was able to get to the car, who spoke German, and move it forward, enabling the people the other side of the road to get into it, and they took off. And because I was then out, you know, away, split from them. So I went back to the Point de Repère, which was a farm, and obviously now the situation was very dangerous because the Germans knew there was something going on. And I had one contact at the farm who had been with us, and we went, tried to get back to the road, thought, well, the others might have waited or something. But the Germans, in the meantime, came down, were just spraying the field with machine gun fire, so clearly one couldn't get through. So I thought, well, there's no point in messing about. I can join them, you know, a little later on. But the next thing that happened, I contacted two gendarmes who had been helpful to us in getting the car in the first instance, and they gave me some information which rather changed my mind about things. They informed me that the Americans were breaking through very rapidly and were getting, had suddenly, they had reconnaissance advanced parties that were really getting quite close. So I got the thing to do is to try and find out what the Germans are doing, where they're putting out their last-ditch posts and such like, but I couldn't do it in daylight in uniform. So they equipped me, and I became a farmer's aide or assistant. They got me a carte d'identité, carte d'alimentation. I became Louis Simon Matt, student of architecture at the University in the north of France. And